Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Right, welcome. Thanks for coming. We've got two great guests here tonight. So I want to welcome to the Melbourne Writers Festival. We want to respectfully acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and all their elders, past, present and emerging. Today we have a real great discussion today about the book that Marcia and Aaron have written. So I'll just introduce our guest today. Professor Marcia Langton AO is a descendant of the Yiman people of Queensland. She's qualified as an anthropologist and geographer, and since 2000 has held the Foundation Chair of Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. In addition to her many academic publications, she's an award-winning author. Her most popular book is Welcome to Country, A Travel Guide to Indigenous Australia. And she has also reached a large audience through her contributions to documentary series such as First Australians and The Australian Wars, produced and directed by Rachel Perkins of formerly Blackfella Films. And she edited and contributed to First Australians, All Illustrated History with Rachel. Professor Aaron Korn is the inaugural director of Indigenous Knowledge Institute at the University of Melbourne. He has a background in music and collections and has long collaborated in research and education initiatives with Indigenous knowledge holders. He serves as the director of the National Recording Project for Indigenous Performance in Australia and as a board director of the International Council for Traditional Music Study Group on Indigenous Music and Dance. Can we just give him a pause?
Thanks.
I'll just give you a little bit about myself. I'm Eddie Cabello. I'm a Larrakia, Wadjugan and Central Aranda man from the Northern Territory. I'm currently the director of the Law and Indigenous Help at the Melbourne Law School. I'm also a former practicing solicitor, former anti-discrimination commissioner, and also worked on the recent Royal Commission up in the Northern Territory. So, I mean, it's a real pleasure, Marcia and Aaron, as, you know, we've been talking over the years, and I've known Marcia back when I was doing my undergrad, and was always a little bit fearful, Marcia, to be honest, but... and I remember you when I finished my studies, my law studies, and you pulled me up in Mitchell Street and said, don't practice criminal law. Go into corporate law. And I was like, yeah, no worries, Marcia. And then, sorry, I didn't. So I always remember that day, Marcia, but it just didn't seem the right place for me to go. But I really watched from afar and really, respect the hard work that you've done in all areas, not only just in your field, but right across. So when you asked me to come and do this, I was, you know, a little bit tentative, but, I didn't want to disrespect yourself in that, but... And I think that goes to the whole concept of the ways of the ancestors. And I think over this journey, there's been, you know, a lot of fights for Indigenous Australians, and unfortunately, there's not enough written in this space on Indigenous laws to really be there to try and shape the the landscape in the legal area. So, in saying all of that, I just really wanted to ask you straight off the bat, what has led you to write this book, and what did you want to achieve? And I suppose that's for both of you.
Yeah. So, Sally Heath, the publisher of Thames and Hudson approached me to consider writing a book in this First Knowledges series. So Songlines had come out. I'd actually read a pre-publication manuscript of Design by Alison Page and Paul Memmott, and then I'm not quite sure of the order after that, but in any case, you had Country by Bruce Pascoe and Bill Gammage, and Plants by Michael Sean Fletcher, Zena Cumston, and somebody who Leslie Head, former Professor of Geography at the University of Melbourne. And Michael is, in fact, the Director of Research Capability at the Indigenous Knowledge Institute. And so I, of course, wanted very much to be a part of the series, because there's nothing more important than communicating to the Australian public the truth about our world. The rule of the series is that each Indigenous author has to have a non-Indigenous co-author. And so my longtime colleague, and we just worked out that we've worked together for 25 years on and off, was the obvious choice. Sally put it to me to write a book on leadership. I hummed and hawed from the beginning. I couldn't see the point of writing a book on leadership. So when we got down to discussing it, we landed on the fundamentals of law. You know, because a leader has to be legitimate. What makes a leader legitimate? Compliance with laws. And not just compliance with laws, but representing those laws in a genuine, authentic and ethical way. So we tackled the problem of Aboriginal law and how could we explain it to the Australian people, especially young people who have been raised to believe that Aboriginal people don't have any laws except for the possible exception of native title, but even then that's not seen as law. And so we proceeded from there to use our own experience, everything that we've learned in our lives from the old people who've taught us, to explain how Aboriginal laws work. But though, of course, it's different across the country, so we provide, you know, examples of different kinds of law, different ways that law is practiced. But I'll leave it there for the moment. Aaron, did you want to add anything?
I think you covered it beautifully, actually. Look, for me, it was just a great opportunity to work with somebody who I've, you know, known and respected and had a huge impact on shaping me professionally and intellectually in terms of you, Marcia. And I think in terms of the content of the book itself, you know, we don't have a great understanding of this stuff, which we'll obviously get into later. And, you know, primarily for me, it was a way of trying to show some respect to all those people whom Marcia mentioned, many of whom aren't public figures and perhaps never will be, some of whom are no longer with us, who keep on teaching a lot of different people in Australia and from around the world about their law and why it's important and why it makes you a good human being and why it can potentially have learnings for everybody. And they do this tirelessly and relentlessly, often to an audience that has no idea what they're trying to tell them. So for me, it's my homage to both Marcia and to all those teachers as well.
And of course, back in the late 80s and early 90s, I worked for the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody in the Northern Territory. And I had to write a report for the commissioners on what I found. I was given terms of reference. I had to find out what were the underlying issues leading to the deaths in the Northern Territory. And everywhere I went, the elders said, the main problem is that white law doesn't recognise our law. And one of the chapters in my report is called Two Laws. And I provided detailed transcripts of exactly what was said to me by elders in 1989 and 1990 in about 30-something communities that I went to At that time, you know, you'll remember that, or you might have been a bit young back then, but possibly the only recognition of Aboriginal law, formal recognition of Aboriginal law, was in sentencing. So some evidence could be given in a very prescribed way about Aboriginal law matters in order to make submissions about the sentencing of a defendant. It was entirely inadequate, but there was an informal, and that ended more recently, an informal way of recognising Aboriginal law where occasionally the courts would allow elders to punish people before the courts punish them. But it ended because of the principle of, you know, avoiding double punishment. Which is a terrible shame. And, you know, with all of the carry-on, most of it confected, about, you know, youth crime in Alice Springs, it's very obvious to me that, you know, you can draw a straight line from what people were describing to me back in the 1980s to the disintegration of social order in towns like Alice Springs. Because Aboriginal law and the people who implement Aboriginal law, you know, the authorised elders, are prevented from governing their people in these contexts. The police, the courts, service providers, government departments, child protection agencies all interfere to deny Aboriginal law holders the right to tell people how to behave in their societies. And so what has happened over the last three or four decades is that the disintegration of law and order in the Aboriginal world can, as far as I'm concerned, you know, this is very, very clear to me, can be sheeted home to the denial of Aboriginal law. And most people don't even understand that it exists. In the first place. And so they blindly, you know, throw their weight around in our world and cause more harm. And they can't see it. So this is step one. This book is step one. It doesn't say everything that needs to be said. It's very much a surface treatment of a huge body of knowledge. But it's what needs to be said at this point. So it's kind of a building block for educating Australian citizens about how to understand Aboriginal law and how to have respect for it.
And I think that's what's missing when it comes to the legal profession. And I think from someone who's currently teaching in law, I think there's a disrespect there as well in regards to how we speak about our First Nations people. And our laws isn't really covered properly. So in saying that, your publisher says, writes, there's no current publication that achieves the clarity and explanation of these ancient bodies of law and knowledge. Could you lay this out for people in regards to the issues relating to Indigenous law and First Nations legal history are the subject of general discussion in other books, but what makes your book different and how does it contribute to the discussion of the history?
Okay, well, actually, Aaron is very good on this because one of the conclusions that we came to as we were writing this book and grappling with the terminology to use is that anthropologists are incapable of explaining either Aboriginal law and more particularly various vehicles for Aboriginal law, such as kinship. So you'll see in here there's a bit about, you know, kinship and marriage, and we really struggled with it because the anthropological terminology is so awful.
Well, it doesn't mean anything. They're just words that have no actual relationship to the mechanics of the societal structures.
They don't explain anything. They don't really have any meaning. They're labels that make the discipline of anthropology look really scientific. But they're quite ugly terms as well. Mm. So Aaron, why don't you have a go first? And because we had some very good discussions about this very problem.
Well, let me say that probably the next book we want to do together is one where we actually go to those terms and try and redo them so they make sense. And we start with a blank slate. I don't even care at this point what root words we go to, pick a language and use the root words at the moment. But there's a very clear pattern when you have terms that are related to the way that society divides itself. But the one thing I'd say is that all of kinship law, what are we talking about when we're talking about kinship? We're talking about bloodlines and descent. So therefore we're talking about inheritance and property rights. Okay? And in some societies in Australia, we have a very clear view of what those property rights are. When it comes to native title and land rights cases, a lot of the matrilineal descent lines have just been completely ignored in the past by anthropologists going back to the 60s and 70s. Anybody who knows and uses those kinship systems on a daily basis knows precisely that female descent lines are as important as male ones. And in fact, it's hard to have a society without female descent lines because I guess nobody would be born. But anyway, very strange. But the models always emphasise ideals of balance and equity. There are very clear separations of powers in different Indigenous societal models in Australia. They're not like the separation of powers in, Western government structures, you know, church and state and judiciary. They're more based on, you know, who you're married to and what the bloodlines are. But they're there.
Don't use bloodlines, use descent lines.
Descent lines.
Yeah.
But they're there nonetheless. They're there nonetheless, and they're there to make sure that no one group in society has the chance of completely dominating another. And so ideals of equity are written throughout, and, you know, we provide quite clear examples of the book, drawing a lot on the work of Professor Wanta Powell, who works with us at the University of Melbourne. He's a Walpri elder, and also work that we did about 10 or 15 years ago with Dr. Joe Gumbler, who is no longer with us.
Just going on from that, then, Aaron, as a non-Indigenous person who's respected and has a by Indigenous community, but also has the knowledge, what do you think non-Indigenous people and the legal system can learn from Indigenous law?
Look, to me, probably the things that I've learned over the years that I use every day in my life, and this comes back to, you know, less about the hard letter of the law and more about what is it to be a good person, is all of the teaching about respect and responsibility. That, you know, from a very young age, people are taught literally to respect everything, all other people, which of course entails respect for yourself as well. And not just people, but everything in creation around you. And that with authority, as people mature and take on more and more, leadership in their life, that always comes with a sense of great responsibility to the people who you are looking out for. And I think they're the main things that come across for me. I think that there are, you know, some human universals in that that can be found in one version or another across pretty much all societies. And there's a very, I think, you know, beautiful and nuanced tradition of that across different regions of Australia that, you know, is not very well understood and greatly overlooked.
Thanks, Aaron.
Can I just go back to the previous question?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it goes to the problem of people don't even know when they see Aboriginal law in practice or in some expression, they don't even know what they're looking at because they don't understand that Aboriginal law exists, which is why I've used, you know, the film by Rolf Tahir and...
Ten Canoes.
What's his name? So bad with names. His fellow filmmaker, wonderful man, I'm shocking with names, of course...
How about David?
Well, he was the... He, Gorpala was the narrator,
yeah.
But he wasn't the co-director with Rolf Tahir.
Oh, okay.
No. So I use that film...
Oh, it's... says Peter Jiggy out here.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And
it's in the book.
Yes.
Page 123.
Okay. And also, you know, Francis Ring's wonderful dance work about the Big Salt Lake in South Australia. And we agreed that you should definitely use the mosaic by Mr. Nelson Jacamara out the front of Parliament House.
Yeah.
People don't know that they're looking at Aboriginal law. So we tried to give examples so that people could understand, oh, so that's Aboriginal law. Oh, that's how they express their law, you know, just to make it really easy for people. And so there are a few good examples like that. There are many more that we could have chosen. But these are very accessible. And the point being that, you know, see, for instance, many years ago, back in the 90s, the early 90s, I realised that with the High Court recognising at last native title, ditching terra nullius and recognising that native title pre-existed the British invasion, this is in the Mabo No. 2 case, the first High Court case on native title. So they recognised native title, but they... still the legal system would not recognise any of the laws from the entire body of laws of which native title is just one. So, and I wrote about this many years ago, and of course people just think I'm mad, you know, what's she talking about? But of course they think I'm mad and they think my proposition is crazy because they mostly... cannot see that Aboriginal law exists, have been told that it doesn't exist. And, you know, you'll just like in the recent debate about Bruce Pascoe's work, Dark Emu, you know, Aborigines couldn't possibly have agriculture. Don't be ridiculous. It's, you know, the version here is Aborigines couldn't possibly have other laws. Don't be ridiculous, right? So you're up against this blindness, this absolute refusal to see the existence of something that we all know exists, that, you know, most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people know exists. In fact, the Mabo case, you know, rests in large part on the law of Marlow, and evidence, mountains of evidence was given about the law of Marlow.
Yeah.
So it is, I think, you know, the next big challenge in Australia is actually... to get not just the legal profession, but all Australians to see that Aboriginal law exists. Because, you know, just take any example. Instead of grabbing a kid off the street who's mucking up, why not call an elder? Instead of, you know, throwing them into juvenile detention centre, and that's the Royal Commission you worked on, why don't the police and the child protection agencies call a local elder to intervene and see what they can sort out? Why don't they do that? But no,
that's called
every
policing.
Child...
That's called policing.
Yeah. Every child in the juvenile detention system in the Northern Territory is Aboriginal, every one of them, and there are hundreds of Aboriginal children in detention. If you look at the population across Australia of Aboriginal children in detention, it's now in the thousands. So basically the system is removing our children from us. That's not even counting the 20-something thousand children in out-of-home care have been removed from Aboriginal families, right? So underlying the assumption that Aboriginal families cannot look after children is also the assumption that there is no Aboriginal law.
Yeah.
Right? This has very practical applications, but this is really an epistemological challenge. How do we get people to see that Aboriginal law exists? And it still runs. It's not ancient, didn't die out magically with, social Darwinism. It just, it still runs.
Yeah. So just look, the Council of Australian Law Deans have come out and said that the legal curriculum of this country is racist. They've also called out the legal system itself. And so have numerous, chief justices across the country have said similar things when retiring. So, I mean, the reality is, deep down, everyone knows, right? And everyone deep down knows that Indigenous people do have laws.
Mm.
But the system's complicit
mm.
and the biases are really are real, right? The reality is, when I was on the Royal Commission, being Indigenous and living in community, you know the love for children, right? But the overcrowding and all of this sort of stuff plays into the biases of adjudicating whether that child is in a safe home. And that plays up and overrides our legal systems. In the book, you talk about sleeping areas. And they're really strong laws, right? I know for a fact, right?
Yeah.
So those are these laws that the people ain't willing to understand. There have been plethora of inquiries into, out-of-home care, and our practices have been told and told and told.
Yeah.
The laws of our, children and that.
Well, the big... I struggled with how to write about women's law.
Yeah.
Now, when women's law first became an issue in Australian society, it was in relation to a very important women's sacred site in South Australia. And the whole business was called the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Affair. And there was a couple who were invested heavily in developing the bridge. And when the Aboriginal women elders from the area asked for the bridge to be relocated because of a very important women's sacred site there, they went about disproving what these women were saying, and much later it emerged that what they'd done was, basically bribe a male elder with a six-pack of beer or something to rubbish the women in public, and then all of the white male staff, or at least, the senior white male staff at the South Australian Museum said that women's law doesn't exist and that the women were lying, and John Howard's former speechwriter ran a campaign. He was a wealthy heir in South Australia to a flour mill company fortune, and he spent the last years of his life campaigning against the recognition of Aboriginal women's law. And, of course, it went through the courts, and eventually the federal court found that, indeed, there was evidence that this was a women's site. It had been actually reported by David Unipon back in the 1930s, but his book had been stolen by a white man who published it under his own name, Robert Smith, right? And much, much later, people came to recognise that Robert Smith had stolen David Unipon's book. But in the manuscript of that book, there's reference to this site. So it's been well known in the Aboriginal community for decades. It's even in the Aboriginal written record. The federal court finally recognised it. But by this time, John Howard's speechwriter had whipped up, he passed away, had whipped up such an hysteria. Some of the older people in the room might remember, you know, it was all, you know, voodoo and lies.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
And you know, the fact of the matter is that there's women's law everywhere because there are women everywhere. And not only does women's law apply to how families are managed and how all sorts of inheritance is passed on, but it also applies to landscape and places and so on. So that Hindmarsh Island Bridge affair was back in the 1980s and we've advanced a bit. But at the same time, do you know in the Northern Territory, in land claims, we couldn't get women traditional owners recognised. The anthropologists had skewed the whole business of recognising land rights under the Land Rights Act in the Northern Territory and completely denied that there were women traditional owners, that there were women apical ancestors, that there were women's laws. And, you know, I can name the white male anthropologists who did this, right? But they actually taught me at the Australian National University. And they went on to become, you know, the main informants for the courts and the legal profession on how Aboriginal society works. And so mostly the women anthropologists wouldn't do anything about it either, because they were married to the white white anthropologists, right? So it's been a long struggle to undo the damage caused to Aboriginal society, not just by that part of history, but earlier. You know, why are we here? We're here because our Aboriginal male ancestors were murdered. In my case, that's certainly true. I don't know if it's true in your case, but it must be. Yep, you're nodding. And women survived on the frontiers and pulled together, you know, the remnants of our society during the frontier wars and held the thing together, right? And that's still happening today. But nobody recognises it, because white Australian society is inherently misogynist. So all the white bureaucrats, the white ministers for years, they were white men, and they go to Aboriginal men to ask what's going on. Whereas how families are run, who has what name and why, that is governed by women. And the kinship system is largely governed by women. And so, you know, this starts with birth. So who gives birth? Women do. What happens at birth? There are rituals and ceremonies and the expression of law, or what we call women's law or grandmother's law, for babies right from birth.
Naming.
So it goes to naming you know, reciting who they're related to and how they're related to people. And so, therefore, it's not bloodlines, because family relationships are social constructs. They're not biological. They're social constructs, and they're governed largely by women from birth. And much later, in, you know, teenage years is when men come in to the governance of children. Much, much later. Of course, you know, people have dads and dads do certain things, but so we've called the chapter Gendered Business and talked about women and men, because the system operates in an interrelated way. It's, you know, men's business and women's business is necessarily entangled. And I talk about how, especially in the desert areas and some other areas, there's very demarcated men's business and women's business. That's not the case everywhere. But it does have a big influence right across Aboriginal Australia. And, you know, it's very difficult to talk about because just like men's business, in women's business, there are very secret matters that none of us are allowed to talk about or you know, even hint at in public. And so this is why there was all that hysteria about the Hind Marsh Island case. John Howard's boy hadn't heard of it, so therefore it didn't exist. And, you know, it's that problem of the invisibility of Aboriginal law in the white imagination over and over again, but particularly in relation to women, and you can see it now in the rates of removal of Aboriginal children from their families and the number of children in the juvenile detention system across Australia.
I suppose probably one of the laws that gets a big flogging is payback.
Yeah.
Which is, from my short time in the law, has been bastardised by the legal profession.
Yeah.
In so far as that when lawyers are standing on their feet in court, they just want to have a win.
Yeah.
And I think the discussion you just had in regards to women's business and that is also, you know, similar traits where we throw out the reality of what it means, because the reality is there's all this mediation and everything prior to all of that. Aaron, would you want to just touch on it a bit? Or?
Not so much payback, but, you know, to reflect on what you and Marcy were just saying. Look, I can remember nearly 20 years ago being told by, you know, anonymous reviewers of articles I was writing that, you know, I mean, there's just no way people in societies like the Yolngu Society of Northeast Arnhem Land could have concepts like law or constitution or alliance or federation. Of course, all those things exist, but, you know, it was just completely alien to, I don't know who these reviewers were and I didn't take any notice of them, but it was completely alien to people, and I was suspecting it's still very much alien to people today. You know, you've been talking about how, you know, law and law people are invisible. You know, let's think about all the way that those people are pushed to the margins of power structures that we live in. And, yeah, you know, we see somebody singing a song or, you know, wearing some paint or doing a dance and we think, oh, well, that's nice. It's entertaining. We usually fail to recognise that those things are expressions of law that haven't just survived colonisation. They've survived the last sea level rise of 10,000 years ago. You know, these are the continuous traditions as far as we can know. How do I know that songs in Northeast Arnhem Land, which is what I'm thinking of, survive at least 10,000 years? Well, they sing about things like freshwater vents that are now 30 metres underwater that you used to be able to walk to because you used to be able to go there before the sea level rose. And we just have this collective blind spot around these things. We relegate sacred expressions of law to artistic expressions because that's the only frame in which we think we can understand them. I allegedly study music, which sounds safe and warm and fluffy. And yet I find myself sitting here for reasons that I couldn't possibly imagine. But, you know, when I started working with, you know, arguably the last singers of their traditions in the world, on this continent, they weren't trying to teach me about their music, even though music was the conduit through which they did teach me. They were teaching me about their law. And until we can overcome that blind spot, which is hopefully what we're able to do here together, we might not get very far very fast. I would go so far as to say that law people, and I won't go into degrees of observance because that doesn't matter, I'd say that law people are possibly the most persecuted group of people in this country because most of us don't even imagine that they might even exist. They're completely invisible.
They're treated with such disrespect.
Completely invisible.
Even by young Aboriginal people, which we were talking about before. let's talk about an example.
Mm.
So, for instance, you know, one of the first big aspects of women's law that I learnt in the desert, and it was just happenstance, really. I happened to be in the right place at the right time. Was the seven sisters dreaming, and I learnt from old women. You know, this was back in the 80s, about the Pleiades and what that constellation means and how it, you know, is manifested on Earth and in people. And I went to a number of Seven Sisters ceremonies and learnt more and more each time, and I was told, don't you ever say anything about this. And, you know, sometimes I was made the cockatoo. I had to sit on the outskirts of the ceremony and make sure no men came anywhere near the place. I think that was a way of making me behave myself, you know. And it's not being a nuisance to them. So, and now, you know, you have this magnificent exhibition that's been shown and toured on the Seven Sisters Dreaming, and, you know, a great deal of it is open knowledge now. But once upon a time, it was very cloistered. There were very subtle ways of keeping the knowledge, not just secret, there are aspects of it that are absolutely secret and remain so, but that, you know, the sort of the outer knowledge was shared very discreetly and could only be shared by people with a very particular authority. And it's not just descent, it's actually from attending ceremonies and yeah. learning the ceremonies and having what people recognise in them as, you know, a connection to an ancestor, and it's a power.
The
right?
stuff you build through the leadership.
It's a particular yeah. spiritual attribute that's evident in a person.
Yeah.
So, in that regard, you write extraordinarily well in the book about the Southern Cross and Dark Emu as constellations. So, you know, everything in the sky is reflected on the earth, and it's these great constellations, and you know, the dark parts of the sky and the Milky Way that represent in many ways these sort of the grand ideas of Aboriginal law. So you know, just say a little bit about, you know, say for instance the Southern yeah. Cross or the Dark Emu.
Well, that work, firstly, you know, I'll acknowledge that work all comes from the work of Professor Wanta Powell, who works with us in the Indigenous Knowledge Institute. And, you know, through the meetings we've had around the book, when he was reading final pages of it, you know, to make sure that we had got it right and reflected his previously published work properly, you know, we were actually able to, you know, pitch the idea of a book by him, you know, that Thames and Hudson will do in the future. So hopefully that will be out in, you know, maybe 2 years, we're hoping. But, you know, The Walpri ideas, which do stretch across broader parts of the continent and, you know, pretty much link up everywhere broadly writ that has a border with the desert, which is nearly everywhere, you know, a fairly universal. It's not completely the same everywhere you go. There are always regional differences wherever you have a species or environmental change, you will always have details that change in the way that people interpret law as they're, you know, reading their homelands and country. But certainly things that are in the sky and can be seen in the night sky tend to be more broadly recognised because, of course, everybody can see them. Having said that, as you go down the continent and the latitude changes, of course, where certain constellations connect with the horizon at certain times of year is different. So in the Walpri context, which in itself spans about 700 or 800 kilometres north to south, it's bigger than a lot of other countries in the world out there, it's when the pointers touch the horizon. And the Southern Cross is like a yam underneath the surface of the earth, beneath the horizon. That's when ceremonies are meant to start every year. And there's a whole annual cycle of ceremonies that, you know, would usually be done. And that usually falls around October. In different parts of the country, it's different things. But these constellations signal basically the calendar. and tell you about the seasons and tell you about when people should start moving together by reading the sky. All of that, of course, also plays into ideas of balance, that what is reflected above is practiced below. That Parliament forecourt design in Canberra that Marcius spoke about before, well, what is that a design of? Well, it's a design of a Walpole conceptualisation of effectively a representational gathering. It's a Jadiwampa. It's a Jadiwampa ceremony, which is the first ceremony of the annual cycle, which is a fire purification ceremony. And it is used to put to bed any disagreements, hostilities or enmities that may have arisen in the previous year, so that when ceremonies start, everybody starts from a place of peace, balance and unity. So you don't bring your enmities into the ceremonial space. That fire ceremony is fundamental, therefore, to ensuring that there's good governance and process throughout everything else, and that people have to get along, even if they do have disagreements. And the forecourt design represents this in a really interesting way, because, of course, it has people coming in from four cardinal directions, representing the four intermarrying ceremonial groups in Walpole society. Every single person in Walpole society will have a descent line through each of their four grandparents from every single one of those four groups. So they themselves are not just a member of one, but a balanced combination through the intermarriage of all four. And therefore, nobody is above anybody else. Everybody is equal on that grid. That grid of the four cardinal directions and the four ceremonial groups and the different parts of law that they have to deliver for everybody through the ceremonies that they run. Each of the four groups has a different part of ceremony that they run on behalf of everyone. That is also reflected in the night sky, because, of course, the template that's used to come up with this idea for social organisation and balance is the Southern Cross, which is almost like the navel of reality, so to speak. The most interesting thing that Wanta says about the Southern Cross, and hopefully he can be on the stage one day in the years ahead to tell you himself, but the reason that the fifth star is off centre is that it's a reminder. Right? So when Walpole people paint this motif of the Southern Cross, the central star is always in the centre. That's where it's meant to be. But in the night sky, it's off centre. And the reason it's off centre is as a reminder that if you don't maintain law, and if you don't maintain good governance, and if you don't maintain respect for you for everything, then you will lose yourself and you'll become, as Wanta says, homeless in your own home.
Thank you, Aaron. We're running out of time. Maybe go to the audience for a question or two. Yep. Anyone, you can pick it.
Hi. Thank you very much, Marcia and Aaron, for that contribution. I'm a pale male privileged lawyer. I'd like you to imagine in 4, 5 or 10 or 20 years down the track, you're negotiating treaties. Treaties are rights of self-government, including administration of law. What are the 5 or 6 or 10 principles regarding the self-governing administration of customary law that you would like to include in those treaties, under which different communities around Australia would self-govern their communities applying their own laws?
That's a great question. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I don't know if you're familiar with the Native Title Act. Is it Section 223 or 225? Yes. 2231, thank you. You know, it's a way of defining, if you like, native title in such a way that, you know, Aboriginal people can't say what it is. Only lawyers can tell us what it is. Now, I know that I'm wildly misrepresenting your profession there, but from an Aboriginal point of view, that's what Section 223 and its impact looks like to us. So here's the thing about native title. You know, it's one part of our whole system. The thing about native title is, imagine, you know, this is a tabletop and this is the moment of British annexation. And then everything above it is the, you know, the colonial and post-colonial history, and everything below it is Aboriginal history, the 65,000 years before the British came. Now, the court said this law didn't stop with British invasion, it kept going. The lawyers couldn't cope with it. They couldn't cope. So some years after the first iteration of the Native Title Act, they had to get in Section 2231 so that they could define native title and say what it is. It couldn't be what the common law said, what the High Court said it was. It was whatever the traditions and customs of the Aboriginal, you know, or Torres Strait Islander people said it was. Now, just say, for instance, in my laws, it's pretty bad, but it's not terrible. But just say it's a really terrible crime for a young person to sit on the place where an elder sleeps. That's actually one of our laws. Absolutely not allowed to sit on an elder's bed or swag or where they sleep, right? So we say that's our law. We submit it to a court and the court says, no, it's not enough evidence. Doesn't fit in with Section 2231, so it doesn't exist. Mm. That's how the Native Title Act works, to refuse to recognition to native title law according to the traditions and customs of Aboriginal people. You know, like it famously happened in the Yorta Yorta case in the federal court. The judge said, the explorers' journals say this, so that's the truth, and what the Aborigines say is not being recognised because the explorers' journal has precedence over what Aboriginal people say, because it's written down by a white person. So when it comes to treaties and the recognition of Aboriginal customary laws, we absolutely must not have a Section 2231. Customary law can only be what we say it is, you know, by common consent amongst a group of people, because law is necessarily practiced by a group of people. It's not an individual thing. And if enough people say, yep, that's our law, you're not allowed to sit on an elder's swag, then the court is obliged to recognise what we say it is and must not circumscribe it in any way with a statute that gives lawyers and the courts the upper hand in saying what exists and what doesn't exist. Now, that it's tremendously important to say that, and I don't know if I'm getting the message through, but it also applies to sovereignty, or what's called sovereignty. This fashion for talking about sovereignty has taken off since Michael Mansell raised it back in the day, around the time of the Native Title Act, because they, you know, the boys always had to be much more radical than us poor flogs who were, you know, negotiating with government. And, of course, you know, what's the most radical thing you say? Well, it really started with Paul Coe. The most radical thing you can say is that Aboriginal sovereignty exists. And, of course, it was Paul Coe's case that was completely dismissed by the High Court. And so ever since, there have been people saying it does exist, it does exist. But what is it? What are they talking about, you see? You will never get a definition out of Mansell or Lydia Thorpe or Gary Foley or Paul Coe. They won't tell you what it is. But, of course, it is actually very well expressed in law and has been for a very long time. In fact, in one of my papers, I referred to the view of an African jurist, and then, you know, the right wing went off their heads and said, you know, we're trying to bring in African law to Australia now. African law. African law. Oh, my goodness. Of course, you know, the British colonised most of the great swag of Africa as well. That would be why. So I just want to go to this point in the Uluru Statement from the Heart. I'll read the paragraph before. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is, and this is a quote, a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. And that comes directly from that Western Sahara case and the opinion of an African jurist. Oh, my goodness.
So,
shocking. This is the main point. Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time. I'm getting a wind up behind us there.
No, it's okay. It's okay, Eddie. We've got time.
Do we?
Aboriginal time.
We got time, mate.
Yeah.
So good.
BT
so
time.
Good. We got time.
So can we just put our hands together for Aaron and Marcia?
Thank you.
Thank you. Both.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you very much.
Both Aaron and Marcia will be out signing. So if you want to get your book signed or buy a book, they'll be at the front there. Again, look, it's a really important book. I really encourage you to read it. It's something that I'll be pushing our law school to purchase for our first year law students. And I just really hope that people start to really think outside our limited scope of our law and really accept that our First Nations people are still on country, still practicing the laws till this day.
Can I say one more thing then on that front? Stop using English as the language through which you're trying to understand this stuff. It's never going to work. You have to go back to the root languages. In the book, as much as possible, we went to great lengths to try and understand what legal concepts actually mean, not what we think they mean, and not laundered through terminology that is now nearly a century old and really is not very accurate.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.